This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Spotlight, episode number 2, was pre-recorded to air on September 13th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Our topic in this episode is private vaulting of precious metals. My guest is Bob Coleman, founder of Profits Plus Precious Metals and Idaho Armored Vaults. Bob has a fascinating personal backstory. He was a high net worth individual investor who became convinced by the very popular argument favoring physical ownership of precious metals for the sake of having assets completely outside the financial system. When Bob set out on his own due diligence mission to find a private facility to store his own gold and silver holdings, he discovered that virtually all such services are owned and operated by precious metals dealers or banks. Bob concluded that this posed a serious conflict of interest, because after all, if the whole idea is to hold safe haven assets outside the mainstream financial system, then keeping them vaulted with a company that is part of that system and is likely to fail in the event of a systemic crisis hardly makes any sense at all. After being unable to find any secure storage facility that met his own standards of independence from the commercial banking system, Bob set out several years ago to create one. Today, Bob believes that his facility, with just over $220 million of privately owned assets in storage, is the biggest completely independent private vaulting service in operation anywhere. There are certainly plenty of larger competitors, but they're all owned by banks, precious metals dealers, mints, and other parties Bob perceived as having a conflict of interest with operating a truly independent vaulting service. I think you'll really enjoy this interview, regardless of whether you're personally on the market for private vaulting services. I learned quite a bit myself in the process of recording it. I'll be back with Bob Coleman right after this. Joining me now is Bob Coleman, founder of Profits Plus Capital Management and Idaho Armored Vaults. Bob prepared an excellent slide deck with all sorts of background information on private vaulting of precious metals. You can find the download next to Bob's picture on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Bob, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been in the precious metals business for more than 25 years, with an emphasis on physical gold and particularly the secure private vaulting of precious metals. But before we even get to that, I'd like to start with the bigger picture issue of why so many experts prefer physical precious metals in the first place. After all, it's much easier to just buy gold through an ETF like GLD, and you get the benefits of instantaneous liquidity when you go that route. So what's the argument for owning physical bullion over so-called paper gold?
That's a great question. On slide number 3, we look at the distinction between ownership versus representation of metal. One commonality for buying gold, for instance, is reducing systemic risks and counterparty risks. What many are not aware of with ETFs, for example, is the relationship, the trust, or the ETF has with its custodian. Many ETFs, for example, use LBMA custodians to vault the gold that's in the trust. The actions of these custodians are not determined by contractual arrangements, but actually LBMA rules and practices. In these instances, the trust or its owners may not have recourse from the custodian or the subcustodian for metal that is lost or damaged by the subcustodian. This is spelled out in offering documents and prospectuses and so forth. These are real risks to the actual physical ownership of the trust metal that needs to be looked at.
Okay, so buying GLD or something, you're really buying an interest in a financial instrument. You're buying a piece of a trust. And as long as the financial system is still working, that's really a pretty safe claim on its assets. But of course, the reason you're buying gold in the first place, or one of the reasons, is to have a hedge against things going wrong in the financial system. So it makes perfect sense to favor actually owning the metal. But suppose that an investor is already sold on the idea of owning physical bullion rather than so-called paper gold. hold, such as ETF shares. A pet peeve of mine, Bob, about the private banking industry, which I have a little bit of experience being a victim of, I mean a client of, is that the private bankers love to tell their clients, look, you know, you can buy physical bullion from the private banker, and it's going to be kept in the bank's very secure vaults. And since they're telling you that you're a valued private banking client, you're going to get this seemingly too good to be true deal. They're not even going to charge you any storage fee for vaulting that physical bullion for you. Frankly, Bob, that sounds at first like it's a fantastic deal, and it frankly makes guys like you who charge a fee for vaulting precious metals and other assets in a private vault sound like you're the crooks in this story. But those private bankers are usually failing to explain to their clients that the so-called physical bullion that they're buying from a private bank is in something called an unallocated bullion account. And the implications of allocated versus unallocated are seldom discussed with the client. So please explain the differences between allocated and unallocated bullion accounts. What do those terms mean? And particularly with respects to the rights of the account owner, if the bank itself were ever to become insolvent.
To go back, I guess you have to understand what unallocated truly is, especially in some of these bank accounts and programs. The assets of an unallocated account are not individually separated or owned by the end client. In many instances, you are an unsecured creditor, and the so-called gold may only be backed by the actual balance sheet of the company selling you the service, not the physical product. I think that's a big distinction. What you want to look at is truly the agreements and offering documents in slide number 6, for instance. Just read through those documents, and it should explain the program a little bit better. Basically, the gold is the property of the bank or the program. In an allocated account, physical product is actually set aside for the end client. This reduces some risks that prevail in an unallocated account. It is important to note how that metal is set aside in allocated accounts. A prominent example, for instance, is a bank program that ran into issues in the mid-2000s and it had a heavy press, and it could research this very easily on the internet, is Morgan Stanley's silver program. In the mid-2000s, plaintiffs had sued Morgan Stanley, alleging the program had no silver when the plaintiffs had repeatedly asked and was denied delivery. Oddly, the case was settled right before it went to court. Another little-known risk is also fee discrimination, and this goes along the lines of unallocated and allocated, but it's actually a broader issue in the industry. This puts the entire vault and its exposure at risk, and not very many people are aware of this. Very common in the IRA business, for example, IRA custodians and storage companies reach an attractive fee arrangement to capture assets and be competitive in the industry. The storage fees that are charged by the IRAs for storage may be 10 or 20% of what a private account would normally be charged. The lack of fee revenue makes it more difficult to fully insure and secure not only the assets in the IRA, but all the assets in the facility itself. For example, a facility had $100 million in storage, and they were only charging 15 basis points instead of, say, for instance, normally 75 basis points or 1%. That 15 basis points only represents $150,000 in revenue, and that would be enough to maybe cover 3 employees and their health benefits, but you'd have also insurance and security and lease and other types of expenses. So it's important to make the distinctions of who's actually benefiting from these programs.
Okay, so the key point there is in an unallocated bullion account, which is usually what the private bankers are pushing, you don't even own the gold. You don't have any legal title to the gold. You are an unsecured creditor of the bank, and if the bank goes under, you get in line with all of the other creditors, and the gold that you thought you owned as an emergency hedge was never really yours. Now, I used to think, Bob, and it's actually until I met you and you set me straight on this, I used to think, as I'm sure a lot of other sophisticated investors do, that once you had an allocated bullion account, that meant you owned specific bars or coins that were, you know, just for you. There's a little place that says Bob Coleman on a shelf. This guy owns this stuff. It's nobody else's. You explained to me off the air that it doesn't even work that way in an allocated account, that there are some cases where there are shortcomings to those allocated accounts. So please explain the difference between allocated and segregated, what that distinction means, and what could go wrong with respect to, you know, if I have an allocated account, a lot of people believe they're covered fully. What could go wrong in that scenario?
I kind of look at it between allocated and segregated as public transportation versus a limousine service. With allocated accounts, there's a multitude of risks that surround that, which many individuals, including sophisticated investors, may not be aware of. You need to really look at the relationship with the vault. If you have a fully segregated account, in most cases, you have a direct relationship with the vault itself. And that's a very critical element of physical storage. One of the more popular forms of allocated storage is these master account agreements between the program and the facility. For example, when you sign up with a program, not to mention any names, but there's a lot of programs out there that provide convenience and, you know, you're a mouse click away from owning grams of gold or portions of gold. These middlemen exclusively arrange storage with any facility of their choosing. Although the program may market one large well-known facility, they may choose a different custodian that is cheaper to store most of their metals. These third-party storage facilities have no relationship with the client. So, for example, if you were the end client and you went through a middleman or storage program and you wanted to actually call the vault itself, that storage facility wouldn't even know who you are. In fact, the facility can only take direction from the middleman and not the end client. So that's a big distinction as well. In most cases, the individual client has limited control over their represented metal. If the middleman or gold program wants to move the metal at any time for any reason, the vault facility has to oblige. In these instances, counterparty risk as well as conflict of interest needs to be examined. It's important to note that the program was designed, or the allocated program was designed, to deliver maximum profit for the program's owners and not its clients.
Okay, so my previous understanding, Bob, was that if I had an allocated bullion account, that meant that there's a bar someplace with my name on it. And something that you helped me understand is actually, it's not true. What the allocated account guarantees is that metal has been set aside. But let's say I own 100 ounces, and I assume that means there's a 100-ounce bar on a shelf someplace. There might actually be a 400-ounce bar, which I own a quarter of, and three other guys own a quarter of. And if it ever came down to the bank failing and the court has to get involved, it's not like, well, this one's yours and that one's the other guy's. There's this bar that several people own and they all have a claim on it. And presumably, if you get into a legal battle, that means the court has to go and sell that and split the profits in some way. And it gets really ugly. What I thought allocated meant is really what's called segregated, which is where my metal is separate from everybody else's. So let's focus specifically on allocated accounts with a bullion bank versus segregated private vaulting of precious metals, where I have a relationship with the vault and you can't move my stuff. Because it's amazing to me, if I own an allocated account, from what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, and I believe that I've got an address someplace where I think that the bank has the vault at this address that's got my metal in it, they could move it without even telling me. And they still have it someplace, and I don't know where it is. But with a segregated account, then I have to know at all times where my gold is. Is that only available through private vaulting services, or do the bullion banks offer segregated services as well? How does this work, and what are the trade-offs?
There may be segregated services that certain bullion banks may offer, but typically, especially over in Europe, everything is done on an allocated basis or unallocated basis. Really, it's more of a U.S. type of thing that where you find segregated services. Another distinction, too, with understanding the difference between allocated and segregated is that, you know, for instance, a dealer, which is very popular, will open up a storage facility, and they'll also, for instance, sell. Say you have 10 clients that buy 100 ounces of silver each. That dealer could then buy a 1,000-ounce bar to represent those 10 clients, and that would actually be allocated as well. The real issue came to light basically when the financial crisis happened in 2008, and people started to actually ask for delivery. Before that, you never really had much of that. Most people bought metal, but they assumed everything was fine, and there wasn't a need to actually take physical delivery of metal. So the moment that actually happened, that's where the system sort of fractured. And a very big case was HSBC closing down their retail vaults in 2009, and it took almost 3 months for clients to get their metals out of that situation, or they were moved to another facility. But looking at the distinction between allocated and segregated, it's important to look at the available documents, the account agreement, who you're contracting with. Are there a middleman between you and your metals? Do you have a direct relationship with the actual vault? How is the vault structured? Are they owned or associated with a gold dealer, a real estate holding company, or other type of transactional business like a bank? Determine the storage facility's ability to be a standalone going concern. These are questions that you want to really be asking to understand the framework of how you're storing your metal. What form of metal is being represented in a bullion bank account versus the actual metal that is owned in a private segregated account? This is also important. The example that you provided, you may actually want to take delivery, for instance, if everything hits the fan, but you may find out that you only have a piece of a larger bar. And at the time, that larger bar cannot be reduced down into smaller form because, like we had in 2008, everybody wants smaller form of metal. They want to get out of the larger bar so they have something in a barter form. And this was a big issue, especially in the silver market in 2008, 2009, where it took 4 months to get good delivery of silver. And that was either from refiners, mints, anybody out there.
Bob, there's one bit of advice that I've heard from several different sources, and that is that wealthy families, high net worth individuals, and so forth, should consider vaulting at least some of their precious metal holdings in a country other than their primary country of residence. What's the rationale behind that advice? And quite frankly, is that legitimate advice, or is that just a sales pitch from some of the offshore vaulting guys?
I think for U.S. investors, most of the time it is a sales pitch. No country is immune from all risks, including political or regulatory. There are many risks when dealing overseas, for instance. I've read through personally many programs and custom duties. Understand what are the laws in those countries. What legitimate recourse do you have with the facility or program that's actually storing the metal? Most individuals never consider the exit strategy, which is a very simplistic idea. How liquid are the metals at that location? Do they have to be transported back to the place of origin to sell them? What are the politics in the region? Great example is Hong Kong right now and the chaos that's sort of surrounding that city. So when you're really looking at physical metal, you really have to look at a long-term picture. How accessible or expensive is it to get your metals? How expensive is the program itself? A lot of foreign programs are much more expensive than domestic programs. What reporting requirements do you fall into with your own home country? In many instances, some of these programs will require that you file foreign financial asset reports. How are the metals being stored and who are you actually contracted with? A transaction company or the vault itself? And then for foreign investors looking at U.S. storage, foreign investors should consider privacy and political stability, including regulatory and legal framework, and also liquidity via two-way markets at the facility itself. These are important considerations. It's a very difficult situation to individualize per each client because everyone obviously has a different situation. But these are just general questions that you could ask yourself.
One of the reasons that people own physical bullion in segregated storage is they want a safety hedge against a systemic crisis in the global financial system. So I want to talk now about force majeure and confiscation risk. If things ever got really bad to the points where governments themselves were to become insolvent and there's a true crisis in the global monetary system, which frankly, the fear of that happening is one of the biggest reasons that people buy gold in the first place. Is there really a benefit to someone who has gold in a segregated storage facility at that point? Or are governments around the world simply going to change the rules and confiscate all the gold, you know, supposedly for the common good?
That's a good question. It's something I looked at very early on when opening my facility was the idea of nationalization, taxation, confiscation. Storing outside the financial system provides precious time for for investors to react to government decree. Having metal stored in a segregated form makes it much easier to, or much quicker to react to the market environment. For example, the packages are already identifiable and potentially stored in shipment form, ready to be picked up or ready to be shipped out. However, in an allocated account, there may be significant delays in sorting out and providing delivery to each client. One of the issues I looked at in dealing with confiscation is reportability. Our facility is one of the only facilities in the country that doesn't require a tax ID number or social security number to open an account. Privacy, for instance, is another critical element in slide 16. For example, you can review some of the facts there. Although it may be the client's responsibility to declare the items, the most important element is the ability to possess your metal so one can understand the landscape and have the right information to make the best decision. Even during the Bank Holiday Act of 1933, for example, ultimately no one went to prison or was fined. In fact, actually, from estimates that I've read, only about 15% of the metal was actually returned back to the government. And in today's world, we're not on a gold standard. The public's participation is very limited compared to 1933. So if gold was to be confiscated today, it would be very easy to simply cash settle investors out of most of these structured financial instruments, such as ETFs or allocated programs. And in this instance, taxation would be the form of confiscation, not actually physically going and having to turn the metal in itself.
Okay, so presumably if things were to fall apart, what governments would go after first would be the bullion banks and trying to effectively take possession of that gold. And that would probably give people with segregated storage time to react and figure out how to get their gold out of segregated storage before there was any realistic confiscation risk. I find it absolutely fascinating that, am I correct to understand that you actually keep some of your clients' metal already packaged for shipping just to make sure you're ready to send it on a moment's notice? Is that correct?
Yes, that's actually a standard procedure to keep it in double boxed form so that it's ready to go right out the door, or a client can come right up in their pickup truck and we can load it right into the back there. But yeah, it makes it much easier to store, as well as it provides the ability for mobility itself.
Okay, so let's talk about private vaulting. On one hand, it seems like a bank could have a conflict of interest and the investor's gold might not actually be returned to the investor if a really bad systemic financial crisis where the banking system itself was collapsing were to occur. But wouldn't smaller private vaulting companies, like your own, frankly, be vulnerable in many other ways to a failure or crisis of that magnitude? I mean, let's face it, how would I get my gold back if you go out of business because of reasons that are outside of your control?
That is a critical question that I looked at right from the beginning, especially in 2006, 2007. And the way I looked at that question was to remove any type of transaction business or dependence on transaction business from the vault facility itself. So I think what clients need to look at is understand who is funding or supporting the storage facility. In a fully segregated relationship, the client has a direct relationship with the vault. In my service, we are one of the only vaults in North America, again, that does not rely on transaction business. We don't need to buy and sell metal or other types of fulfillment services to pay the bills. The only way we could go out of business is if everyone sold or took delivery of the metal or stopped paying their storage fees. But we have, obviously, protections in place for the latter built into the contract for collecting storage fees. Secondly, how is the facility insured? What type of exposure do they have? How large are their deductibles? If the deductibles are high in order to save money on premiums, a small number of losses could easily exhaust the cash flow of the facility. So there's a lot of going concern, common sense questions you should be asking the facility in terms of their overall structure.
Bob, I want to talk next about government reporting. These days, banks in particular are required to report just about everything to the government. A few years ago, we got this new FBAR requirement where anybody who has overseas bank accounts has to report them to the IRS. Now, in the beginning, people were saying, well, but gold is not a financial account. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that They've now clarified that to where bullion accounts have been classified by the IRS and probably by other foreign government agencies. So are the bullion banks required to report all the details to the government? And what are the differences, if any, in private vaulting?
That's a good question. This goes really beyond banks. It's more of a systemic issue that clients really need to understand very clearly. Many popular gold programs are also required to report to governments or regulators. As rule of thumb, look at the relationship between the client and the program itself. If the metal is not held in a fully segregated form, it may be classified as a financial instrument. If the contract is between the client and not the actual storage facility, it may also be defined as a financial instrument. For example, you're using a middleman or a third party that buys and sells the metal. You have the relationship with the actual transaction company and not necessarily the vault. You don't have a fully identifiable and separated metal that's held in your name only. Those are very good distinctions. When taking delivery from foreign programs, in many cases, those programs will report your holdings to the taxing authority where the metal is being delivered to. So if you're in a state that may charge sales or usage tax for precious metals or a country that has wealth or value-added taxes, those are considerations you need to look at. There are some exclusions within the code that I have identified, which clarifies whether the client needs to report holdings. And then also in Idaho, we're not required to report clients or their holdings to governments. So it's a very private environment that you have here in the state. In addition, it's important to consult, obviously, with your accountant or tax attorney to your specific situation when storing internationally.
Let's talk more about how I get my physical bullion not into, but out of a private vaulting facility if I ever want it back, particularly in comparison to something like an allocated bullion banking account where, as you said earlier, there have been cases in the past where there's supposedly allocated metal. Don't worry, we've got your metal. But people say, okay, I want to collect my metal, and it takes months and months before they can get any satisfaction. So let's suppose that I have an allocated bullion account that allows me to take possession of my metal if I want it, and I also have bullion that is stored in a private vaulting facility like the one that you operate. How do those compare in terms of both pros and cons, what my options are to get gold out, move it to a different secure storage facility? I would think that the banks must all have relationships with, you know, the Brinks trucks and so forth. I don't know if you guys have all those relationships as well for secure delivery. How do the options compare in terms of what my options are to get my metal back if I want it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what clients need to do or individuals need to do is look at what form the metal is being stored in. In allocated accounts, the metal may be in a larger bar form, which you only have a small part of. You have to ask yourself, how long would it take to get your refined bar or coin from the program? In 2008, 2009, like we mentioned earlier, it took 4 months to get good delivery of silver beyond 1,000-ounce bars. If you have enough for a large 400-ounce gold bar or a 1,000-ounce silver bar, which many programs traditionally store because those are typically good London delivery forms of metal, how practical is that form of metal itself? How do you insure it during transit? How easy is it to refine or swap into smaller forms of metal? In a fully segregated account, the metal you deliver in is the exact metal you get upon delivery out. And that's a big distinction. In a segregated format, the client determined the exact form they wanted the metal in when they originally bought it. And this provides a greater deal of flexibility and accessibility with their metal, and especially when it comes time for the exit strategy of taking delivery or selling it back into the market.
That's a really important point, I think, Bob, because frankly, I've been in this situation myself of kind of thinking 400-ounce London good delivery bar, you know, a little bit of an ego boost there to own a couple of those things. Well, wait a minute. The last thing I want in a crisis is for all of my metal to be in one great big 400-ounce bar that cannot be easily split in different places. So how does that work? Do you work with your clients to help them figure out how they should be buying their metal to have it in the right size pieces? Or do you stay out of that and just let the client decide? It seems like a very important issue for a client to get right in the beginning.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, I looked at early on was being part of that transaction, not necessarily as a gold dealer. I don't really represent myself as a gold dealer, more of a, you could call it, purchaser representative, because I think it's important for the client to buy the physical form in the beginning the way he wants it, rather than trying to change it down the road. It gets very expensive when you start getting out of one product and having to ship it out for another product. There's obviously more room for error, potential for loss, that type of thing. So you want to try and keep it as simple as possible, but understanding the different products, understanding the nature that the client is buying the metal for, if it's just an insurance policy or does he want to use some of it to barter with. Obviously, if it's a large amount of money, the smaller the coin or the smaller the size of the metal, the higher the premium, for example. So it's important to make the client aware of, if you buy larger bars, maybe you may be able to buy more metal for your money. Those are all practical points to educate the client on.
You mentioned insurance, and I want to come back to that in specific, because I know that your facility is very well insured, and frankly, it has to be, because you know, you're a relatively small business, and in many ways, I like that a lot better than dealing with one of the really big banks, because frankly, I think the banks are where the biggest risk exists in the global financial system. But as much as being insured with a really reputable insurer, Lloyd's of London or whoever, sounds great on paper, but do those insurance contracts have force majeure clauses that could lead to the loss of my gold in the event of some extraordinary circumstance? In other words, the very circumstances that I bought my gold as a hedge against might have included some kind of financial system collapse. And I wonder if the insurance somehow gets voided when the financial system collapses.
Sure. Well, we have an all-risk policy for the facility, and our transit and courier coverage is also through Lloyd's of London. It's important to note every insurance contract has exclusions. You want to read the storage agreement and understand what may or may not be covered. Force majeure is interesting. It's force majeure, for those that don't know, are events beyond the storage facility's control, such as union strikes if you're shipping metal out with a courier and the courier goes on strike, or wartime or political risks or catastrophes, for example. Market events may also fall under this category. In this instance, the client's representation of holdings may be in paper form or part of a larger bar form. The inability to take delivery could be a covered event or exclusion where the client actually signed away their recourse when opening the account. I think that's a very big distinction. It's something you kind of referred to as, if you do have ultimate systemic risk and you're in a program that doesn't actually have the metal to begin with and they have to refine it or break it down and they can't because of events beyond their control, you could be out of luck, or it could be a delay of getting delivery of your metal. Then one of the things you also have to look at is common clauses scattered throughout contracts. Beyond the force majeure, you have to look at hold harmless agreements, limits of liability, indemnification clauses. These clauses are to protect the program or facility and not the client. I think this is important to look at, because beyond the force majeure idea, there are other legal arrangements that you're agreeing to that may limit your recourse. Our policy has common exclusions that are spelled out in the storage agreement. We do not believe in clauses or phrases that give blanket protection to for the facility. We owe a duty and responsibility to put the client's interest first. I guess that's sort of an old school way of thinking, but that's what we believe in. And because the metal is already stored in the form you originally purchased, a force majeure event may encompass the actual ability to take delivery of the metal, whether from unsafe conditions when shipping out via a courier, or the client's inability to get to the vault, for example, to pick up the metal. These are things I looked at. Social chaos is a very big factor that I looked at when designing the vault. And that's an important note, because when you talk about force majeure, obviously the facility doesn't want to put the client's metal at risk if it may have trouble getting to its final destination. So sometimes it's better to wait or allow the client to come pick it up. With that said, though, it's interesting. We've developed an additional private, armored, and fully insured transportation solution to get the metal to the client where conventional solutions would not apply. And this is something I've invested in terms of an armored car service. that we can deliver that metal anywhere in the 48 states and have it fully insured during that that transit.
Bob, what other considerations exist relative to private vaulting versus bullion banks when it comes to precious metals? Or maybe put in another way, what else do investors need to know about this that I haven't thought to ask you about yet?
I think, how does the facility address such risks as authenticity? A couple weeks ago, you had an article on the internet talking about how J.P. Morgan discovered 1,000 kilobars of counterfeit gold in their vaults. It's important to understand, does the facility, when they bring metal in or when the client buys the metal, are they buying it from a direct distributor from the refiner itself, or are they buying it through a program that gets it through a secondary market? Another thing is to really read the agreement. Ignore all the marketing claims. Slide 25 and 26, I put a list of different claims that are made or sales pitches or advertisements that you could go through. But to understand the differences between what these claims are and what the actual agreement really does say. For instance, storing your metal at a government facility, many people may think, oh, that's the greatest thing in the world because that facility is going to be rock solid. But in reality, governments have sovereign immunity, and they may not be able to be sued in case the metal gets lost or the client doesn't have any recourse to get back any settlement from an issue that arises. Certain things like that many people just don't think about that deep enough. Ask about delivery or transportation options, levels of training and experience, including armored security, use of subcustodians, depths and liquidity for two-way markets in all forms of metals at the facility. Those are good questions to discuss with the facility or the program itself.
Bob, it sounds like a lot of this is really you consulting with the client on how to best achieve their objectives. And obviously, that's going to be completely different depending on what the client's needs are. But for the sake of illustrating this, let's suppose I've got $1 million that I want to allocate to precious metals. And my strategy is basically, look, I'm really concerned about $15 trillion of negative yielding debt, all of these governments that are printing money and don't seem to have any real credible plan to honor all of their obligations. At some point, I think we're headed toward some kind of serious financial collapse. I want me and my family to be safe knowing that we've got physical precious metals that we're going to be able to get back no matter what happens. And I want to allocate some percentage of my net worth to this safety hedge. Let's suppose, for sake of argument, it's $1 million. What do I do? What would you recommend if I were looking at where would I buy the gold? What size chunks would I buy it in? How would I store it with you? How would this all go down?
That's a great question. It's something I do get a lot of. What you have to look at first, I guess, try to keep it as simple as possible. Look at what type of metal you want to own first. If it's just gold, or do you want to mix silver in with the gold? A lot of clients like to have some form of silver or some percentage of silver, especially with the high gold-silver ratio right now. So silver ownership is also something that's looked at, especially from a barter situation. Obviously, you can't take a kilo bar of gold down to the grocery store, but you could take a 1 ounce round or you could spend a 100-ounce bar of silver much easier than a larger bar of gold. So that's the first thing to look at. Once you've determined maybe what percentages of gold and silver you want to own, then you look at the product selection. Ask yourself, why are you owning the metal? Is it for potential barter, or is it for utilization of that product, or is it for an insurance and investment purpose? If it's for investment purpose, just buy as much metal you can for the cheapest premium. And that's typically larger bars, kilo bars, or 10-ounce gold bars. You don't want to go bigger than kilo bars for really the sole reason of the exit strategy. If metal does go through the roof, that kilo bar is going to be worth a lot of money. And the question is, how do you sell that in a situation where you have social chaos or you have economic instability and you can't take it down to your local dealer, or shipping it requires a lot more insurance and security? So keeping it big but not too big. And so once you have that understanding, then it's just a matter of making your mix a product selection up of large bars versus small 1 ounce coins or 1 ounce bars. Most clients typically go as low as 1 ounce product. If you're really concerned about the economics of the country and the ability to barter, then you could look at fractional coinage. But typically, those are a higher premium. So most clients will use 1 ounce product up to kilo bars. And then on the silver side, you'll look at if you do 1 ounce product, a very popular form is buying sovereign coinage in sealed or mint strap boxes. And in that case, you can buy a 500 ounce box that's sealed. And so you have a little bit more legitimacy that product hasn't been tampered and it's fully authentic because the seals haven't been broken. So those are certain things that you can look at when making up that product mix.
Bob, now that we understand the industry a little better, what separates your facility at Idaho Armored Vaults from the other private storage facilities that are available?
The slide 27 gives a little bit of insight, but basically, our philosophy is being creative and flexible with storage services and arrangements for the client. We were one of the first facilities to provide exclusively fully segregated storage facilities. And a great example of the reason why I did that was if you had tampered metal that came into the facility in a segregated environment, it stays within that specific client account and doesn't get commingled in with other accounts. Like in an allocated format, if tampered metal came in, that metal would go into that pile of allocated accounts. That same person 2 weeks later could ask for delivery, may get back a legitimate form of metal, and that tampered metal may be in that pile waiting for someone else to take delivery from it. So it reduces risks across the board. We're one of the only facilities that is not owned by or affiliated with a gold dealer, real estate holding company, financial institution, or armored car company. So we don't rely on transaction business. The storage company's full revenue comes from the actual fees from storing the client's metal. And that reduces conflict of interest and our loyalty to the client becomes that much stronger. We do not require a tax ID number to open up an account. In addition, we were one of the first facilities to provide on a standard basis pictures of all the metal that comes into the facility. So the client not only gets an inventory report, but also gets pictures of the items. And we also are very innovative with other various products and services. For instance, we provide fully insured storage services for safe deposit boxes, foreign physical currency, collectibles, and fine art. Clients can opt out of the normal industry security lien placed on their metal for storage fees by providing physical cash security deposit that can be delivered back to the client at any time. I think that's an important note to look at, especially for clients that are really concerned about any type of obstruction on their metal itself. So if they wanted to say, listen, I'm going to be paying my storage fee on time, but in case I don't, I'll leave you guys a security deposit that you can take from that to pay the storage fees on a quarterly basis. And it also provides the client the ability to get back that physical cash at any time in case we have a meltdown in the banking system, for example, and that cash can be sent back to them.
Bob, you know, I'm sure that the idea that you do not require a tax ID number would appeal to a lot of people. But I have to tell you, it raises a red flag in my mind, because in this world that we live in of heightened government hysteria, it makes me worry that the government's going to get wind of this and say, hey, wait a minute. We heard on Macro Voices, this guy is taking people's gold and storing it for them without really knowing who they are and having their tax ID number. Maybe we should label this outfit, Idaho Armored Vaults, as some kind of money laundering facility that is facilitating terrorism. And before I know it, my gold gets confiscated by the government while you get investigated, even if you're completely innocent and have done nothing wrong. I don't want my gold to be encumbered during the investigation that goes on for 5 years. Should I be concerned about that? Or I guess a better way to put it is, why shouldn't I be concerned about that?
Not at all. We've actually had that question come up in the past. In fact, my registered investment advisory firm that I own, Profits Plus Capital Management, and its subsidiary, Profits Plus Precious Metals, we have a policy and procedure for know your client as well as anti-money laundering policies. So we do follow the practices. One of the advantages that we do that it may be common sense to me, or it's not very well known in the industry, is that one of the reasons why we're involved in the transaction is when the client actually buys the metal and they wire the funds from their bank account, domestic bank account or a legitimate bank account, they've already gone through the system with that bank, with that money coming from a legitimate bank. They've already been scrutinized by the bank themselves. So the money's been cleaned, or it's coming from a legitimate source. And that gives us much more credibility with the client and understanding who they are. We can always take the driver's license or government ID as well from the client to get a better idea of who they are. But for the most part, our clients are everyday clients that are just trying to protect themselves from, you know, the economics of negative yielding rates or the leverage of the financial system. So it's a very common question, but we've already been through that with regulators as well as compliance departments.
Bob, my final question is, I'd like to understand who this is actually for. Obviously, if you've got more than $1 million to allocate specifically to physical precious metals, you really ought to be thinking about a segregated facility as opposed to a bullion bank. I'm very sold on that message. But what about smaller investors? Obviously, if your net worth is $10,000, it doesn't make sense to be even thinking about private vaulting services for your two or three gold eagles that represent half of your net worth. What's the level at which it makes sense for an investor to be considering this kind of facility?
From a practical standpoint, we've always told clients it's always good to have some form of metal within arm's length. So holding it at your house or close by. Once you get to a point of $25,000 or more of metal that's outside of that arm's length situation, then you should be looking at some type of professional storage environment. The reason why I say that is it provides a couple of answers in terms of privacy, security, as well as estate planning. Because sometimes, you know, if something happens to the individual or they're older and they want to have that metal designated to an heir, at least there's some organization around that metal and communication could be provided in terms of to the heirs what that metal is worth and providing a little education to them. For high net worth individuals, another reason to use our services is our creativity. We'll be the first facility, for instance, coming out with a new program. I call it out-of-the-box coverage. Basically, this is where high net worth individuals who want temporary use of their stored collectibles or assets, they can basically take delivery of that metal or of that collectible and have it shipped to them for an event or ceremony, and that they'll be fully insured when that product leaves the facility, while it's in transit and while it's in temporary possession under their control. And then once they're done with that event or ceremony or whatever they're using that asset for, they can then ship it back fully insured and have it delivered back into their storage account or safe deposit box. So there are other reasons to look at fully segregated storage beyond simply, does it make economic sense to simply store some metal with that facility? Can they actually answer or solve other issues as well?
Bob, we haven't talked about how much this costs yet. Now, I know that in the physical gold bullion banking world, 75 basis points is kind of an annual storage fee that seems to be an industry norm. I'm guessing that for the benefits of segregated private storage, it must cost more than that. How much more than that? And what are people actually looking at in terms of storage cost?
Sure. Many facilities out there charge double what that rate is. However, what I've determined, and we haven't changed our pricing structure in over 10 years, is that we charge 80 basis points for silver storage, or we start out at 80 basis points for silver and 0.78% for gold, and that's on an annualized basis. And then that fee drops as the more you store. So the values go up, the lower the fee drops. It goes as low as 50 basis points. And so there's a tiered fee schedule there.
Bob, for our listeners who want to learn more about these services and the other things that you do, please tell them how they can do so.
Yeah, they can actually go to our website, www.goldsilvervault.com, or they could give us a call at 208-468-3600. My direct extension is extension 1. But on our website, they can look at, there's a lot of information that they can gather. They can pull down the storage agreement and understand the responsibilities of the vault and the client. There's also a disclosure document that talks a little bit more about the facility and myself. We're one of the few facilities that also, for clients, when they become a client, they could actually request a copy of the facility's balance sheet so they can get an understanding of the financial condition of the vault itself. So there's a lot of transparency we try to create for the client, but obviously being in the security business, there's a degree of which we have to hold back. But we also can provide evidence of insurance to the client so that way they know that there's an actual policy in place. That policy will dictate the deductible, the amount of total insurance. For instance, we have one of the lowest deductibles in the world. The reason I do that is because of going concern risk. We really look at every aspect that protects the client.
Well, Bob, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.